Welcome to the Model Railroader, your ultimate destination for all things railroading. From trains.com, we bring you step-by-step modeling and construction projects, insightful reviews, tips from the experts, and more. This program is proudly presented by the Audio Information Network of Colorado, dedicated to providing accessible content for all. Find us at aincolorado.org. This program is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print. All aboard!
Thank you for joining us for the Model Railroader magazine. My name is Jason Consul. This is week one of the February 2024 Model Railroader magazine. This week we will be reading from the following articles. Note from the editor, Ask Model Railroader, and When the Penzi Still Climbed the Mountains. From the editor, by Eric White. Lessons from the Dawn of the Hobby. Looking through old issues of Model Railroader, it doesn't take long to realize the issues of the day have been around a lot longer than we might think they've been. Hand-wringing about how we're going to get the youth interested in our hobby before it dies out, for example, has been appearing in these pages for almost as long as the magazine has been around. But some things do change, one being the popularity of the various scales in the hobby. In the 1940s, O scale was losing ground to HO scale, but it was still referred to as the king of scales. Lionel O. Gage trains were among the most popular toys. Upstarts like HO and double O scales were displacing O, but many saw them as too small to be reliable, and the hobby was more focused on building models that would run rather than complete, scenic model railroads that operated like the real thing. But O scale never went away, as evidenced by the two layouts we visit in this issue. Ed Rapp has been in the magazine before. We last visited his layout in the March 2000 issue. The one who introduced him to the hobby was none other than John Armstrong, whose O-scale Canandaigua Southern inspired Ed to go big. Another O-scaler in this issue is Mike O'Connell. He's back with a look at another part of his Pacific Railway and Navigation Company. Mike is the founder of Chooch Enterprises, now a part of William K. Walther's and producer of scenery textures such as streets, retaining walls, tunnel portals, and cast resin freight car loads. While both layouts are large, HO modelers can find inspiration in both with the realization that modeling in their preferred scale would require only half the space devoted to these empires. N-scalers could get away with a quarter of the square footage. Another longtime O-scale modeler returns this issue with a project to create maintenance-of-way equipment for his On 30 Sandy River and Wrangley Lakes layout. Contributing editor Lou Sassy has been modeling in this scale, which uses HO gauge track with 1 to 48 models to replicate main narrow gauge railroading. On 30 may be the most accessible way to get into the world of O scale, since most of the equipment will easily operate on track built to typical HO scale standards. Finally, we take a look at Tangent Scale Models' O scale 3-compartment tank car. This brass and plastic hybrid shows just how much detail can be packed into models built to a quarter inch to 12 inch scale. This is a phenomenal model. As we continue to celebrate 90 years of Model Railroader, we'll naturally touch on topics that have been prominent for decades. At the same time, we'll keep looking ahead to what's coming out in the future. Things are looking bright. This is the Ask Model Railroader section. A main short line you could model. Question: I'm interested in modeling a main short line in HO scale. What can you tell me about the Belfast and Moosehead Lake Railroad in the steam era? From Joel Norman. The Belfast and Moosehead Lake looks like a great subject for modeling. A standard gauge railroad from its completion in November 1870, the B&ML was for more than 100 years majority owned by the city of Belfast. Starting in 1870, the B&ML was leased by the Maine Central, MEC, which connected to the B&ML at its northwestern terminus of Burnham Junction and operated as its Belfast branch until 1925. The line hauled mostly poultry feed from the interchange to agricultural dealers along the route, plus smaller amounts of coal, lumber, leather, fish oil, and fertilizer. Northbound freight consisting mainly of processed fish, shoes, and other manufactured goods originated mostly at Belfast. Other sources of revenue were milk from a large creamery at Unity, Maine, and other farm products from towns along the way. Passengers and mail were carried in a coach or combine tacked onto two of the line's three daily locals. Sanborn Fire Insurance Maps of Belfast from 1923, available online from the Library of Congress at loc.gov/items/Sanborn03430 _006, show a railroad serving a busy, prosperous waterfront. Major rail-served industries include a fertilizer plant, a lumber and cement dealer, a sardine cannery, and a coal dealer, all of which also had intersecting waterfront operations. But as the line's profits started to decline, the MEC backed out of its lease in 1925, turning the BNML back over to the city of Belfast. The railroad bought its own steam locomotives and started running trains under its own name for the first time. After World War II, the steam fleet was replaced by three new General Electric 70-tonners. The railroad lost its railway post office mail contract in 1960 and ended passenger service the same year. The railroad remained profitable until the 1980s, when declining local industry eventually left it with no online freight customers. The BNML became a tourist line until closing down in 2007. 2 years later, though, preservationists reopened the line as an excursion railroad, which still runs today. For more information about the BNML, including links to web resources, see our website at trains.com/MRR/beginners/ask-trains/modeling-a-main-short-line/ for my longer answer to this question. Question: I need some ideas. Though modeling coal mines is popular, what about the coal's destination? The coal needs to go someplace. Steel foundries, shipping ports, and power plants seem typical, but these require a lot of layout space. Any suggestions for other, more compact industries that receive coal? From John Kubala. Though these days coal is mainly used by large industries like those you mentioned, back in the day, there used to be a lot of smaller industries that received coal. An obvious one is the small town coal dealer. Before oil and gas took over as the most prevalent fuels for household heating, every town of appreciable size had one or two coal dealers. All that's needed to model one is a small office, a delivery vehicle or two, and a way to unload the coal. Many dealers would use a trestle, like the one pictured in my HO scale home layout, allowing the coal to be dumped into bins or piles underneath. Larger ones might have an elevator to lift the coal into silos. Smaller ones might use a movable conveyor that extends under the hopper gates to unload the black gold. Check out our December 2012 issue for several articles on modeling the coal business. Not all power plants are large. Some industries are big enough to have their own small powerhouses or boiler houses that are powered by coal. Railroad shops, paper mills, brick factories, glassworks, iron foundries, and other industries could have their own powerhouses, receiving one or two carloads of coal per week. Just add a small brick building with a tall smokestack and connect it to the main plant with electric wires. Food processing industries like produce canneries, creameries, and breweries may have standalone boiler houses that provide steam to sanitize cans, pasteurize milk, and heat fermentation vessels. These would operate and look much like a powerhouse, except instead of electric lines, the buildings would be connected to the plant with steam pipes. From the mid-1800s to the mid-1900s, gas for lighting homes, businesses, and streets was provided by coal gas plants. These were characterized by a large telescoping tank, called a gasometer or gas holder, and a brick process building with smokestack. Though they were mostly shut down by the 1960s, in the steam era that many of us model, coal gas plants would become common in large and small towns alike. For more on how coal gas plants work and how to model them, check out my Ask MR column from August 2023. One last industry requires little to no modeling at all. A team track. Industries without their own rail spurs might still require the occasional hopper of coal. Add a portable conveyor to a paved area alongside a spur, and you can spot a coal hopper there for unloading into wagons, trucks, or trailers. Question from Philip Bailey. I'm excited to lay track on my HO scale shelf layout. I have a few track laying questions. I'm using the new Walther's Track turnouts with the metal tab on the side for powering the frog. Can you point me towards a video or article showing how to wire this? Also, what are the latest hobby paint brands and colors for weathering the rail and ties? I know there have been a lot of changes in paint over the last few years. Finally, I would like to wire and weather the track in the garage before assembling the sections in my office. Any tips for laying and then cutting the track at a layout section joint? Answer. I'll be happy to answer your track line questions. We don't have a video specifically about powering the frogs on the new Walther's turnouts because they've only been out a couple years. But we just used them on our 2024 project layout, Fremont Mills, and powered the frogs with Tam Valley Depot frog juicers. Check out the article on page 53 for an explanation of how we wired that layout model. Correction, how we wired that layout module. We have lost a few hobby paint lines over the years, but there is still a lot out there, including Revell, Vallejo, Humbrol, Tamiya, and True Color Paint. If your favorite brand doesn't have color specifically called Rail Brown and Railroad Tie Brown, there might be something similar under names like Roof Brown, Dark Earth, Dark Leather, or Dark Skin Tone. Most hobby paint makers' websites let you sort their wares by basic color. Just filter for brown. If I were to assemble a layout like yours with separable sections, I would secure the track to the layout surface as a single piece, remove a couple ties on either side of the section joint, solder the rails on each side of the gap into two slivers of printed circuit board, PCB, that will take the place of those ties. Cut a gap in the copper on top of the PCB so it doesn't create a short circuit between the rails. Secure the PCB to the benchwork with screws so the ends of the rail won't move. And only then carefully cut the rails at the section gap using a razor saw. This will minimize the movement of the rail ends so they will align properly whenever you rejoin the sections. I hope that answered all your track questions. If not, look into the Calmback Hobby Store for Jeff Wilson's book, Basic Track Work for Model Railroaders. Question from Bruce Jan, Livermore, California. Question: I want to replace some wheel sets on my 1-32 passenger cars, but don't know where to measure the railroad car wheel's diameter. I'd like to keep the wheel sizes the same with the new as the old so I don't need to deal with alternating the height of my couplers. Is the wheel diameter measure next to the flange or out on the edge? Answer. According to the National Model Railroad Association's Recommended Practice, or RP 25, wheel contour, the diameter of a model wheel set is measured at the widest part of the tread next to the flange. The tread of a railroad wheel, be it on a model or the prototype, isn't cylindrical, but is a section of a cone. The tread slopes at an angle of 3 degrees, making the diameter of the wheel tread closest to the flange wider than the diameter at the inner edge. That's not much of a difference, though, even in large scale. So the difference in diameter between the inside and outside of the tread will be negligible. On the prototype, wheels come in all kinds of sizes. Today, most railcar wheels come in one of four different sizes, 28-inch, 33-inch, 36-inch, and 38-inch. Although there are exceptions, the rule of thumb is that 100 and 110-ton capacity freight cars ride on 36-inch wheels. Passenger cars also use 36-inch wheels. Auto racks and low-profile 70-ton piggyback cars have 28-inch wheels. And 70-ton cars, which includes most older cars, roll on 33-inch wheels. Some intermodal cars fitted with 125-ton trucks have 38-inch wheels. As you mentioned, it's important to make sure that you replace your car's wheel sets with wheels of the same size. So don't go by the rule of thumb, but rather measure your car's wheels before buying replacements. A scale rule should be accurate enough to tell you what size wheels you're dealing with. When the Penske still climbed the mountains. This 43-by-60-foot O-scale layout is set in central Pennsylvania in the 1950s. By Paul Dulkos and Ed Rapp. Photos by Paul Dulkos. The Pennsylvania Railroad has attracted Ed Rapp's interest since childhood. As a 3-year-old, he was mesmerized by an American Flyer PRR K5 running under the Christmas tree. It had a Keystone number plate and square bell pair boiler, like the locomotives he saw at the station near his home. It was an influence he never forgot. Over the years, Ed built several small Pensy-based layouts in HO and N scales as a result of job moves. His interest in Pensy locomotives led him to purchase a brass O scale K4S462 for display on the fireplace mantel, with no thought of running it. After moving to the Washington, D.C. area, Ed discovered his new home was not far from that of O-scale modeler and Dean of the North American Track Planning, John Armstrong. He called John and asked if he could visit. John responded with an invitation to his Sunday night trains get-together. Ed had never seen an O-scale model railroad and was taken by the mass of the models. John's informal group, which included two very knowledgeable Pensy modelers, was welcoming to the newcomer. Several weeks later, Ed brought his K4s to a meeting, and the Pensy guys pointed out the detail shortcomings on his model and how they could be corrected. Ed found that he enjoyed working in the larger scale, as it was easier to see and handle the detail on the models. With the experience, Ed made the decision to convert to O-scale. Learning about the Pensy. With the encouragement of the Pensy modelers in the group, Ed joined the Pennsylvania Railroad Technical and Historical Society, PRRT&HS. Its quarterly publication, The Keystone, became his go-to source for learning about the railroad's equipment, infrastructure, and operations. During the 1970s, the Pensy fans in the DC group would drive up to central Pennsylvania to view and photograph former PRR lines. In 1978, Ed and his family moved into a home in Northern Virginia with a sizable basement. There, he began building an O-scale model railroad influenced by the PRR route he visited with his friends. With selective compression, he chose to model features of the PRR's middle division run to Altoona and the Pittsburgh division climb from Altoona around the famous horseshoe curve to the Gallitzin tunnels. Due to the size and shape of the basement, Ed had to make a number of compromises with the prototype that would increasingly bother him as time went on. The one that bothered him the most was that his horseshoe curve had three tracks climbing clockwise, while the prototype had four climbing in the opposite direction. Another compromise was a coal branch with only one mine on it. While fun to operate, it bore little resemblance to operations on the PRR's busy coal branches. Another inconvenience was that the aisles were a bit narrow for towermen, train crews, and spectators to pass one another during operating sessions. But the railroad ran well, looked good, and was even the cover story in the March 2000 issue of Model Railroader. Layout design. Based on the recommendation of several friends, Ed used Third Planet software to design a new layout. It enabled him to look at the interplay of factors such as route, elevation, grade, radius, turnout size, and aisle width in arriving at a design that took advantage of the available space. A track plan was developed over a two-month period with a 355-foot-long dogbone mainline, similar in concept to his prior layout. A space-saving feature that carried over was a suspended staging yard at the west end of the railroad with five tracks. At 76 inches above the floor, most visitors don't notice it when looking at the scene below. At the eastern end of the route, it has five through and three stub-end tracks. Like the prototype, Ed's horseshoe curve has the four tracks that he always wanted. The middle division section of the main line is three tracks instead of the two on his prior layout. The additional track enables through trains to pass local freights working towns on the line. One non-prototypical feature in the track plan is the Altoona cutoff, which connects Altoona with the middle division at Forge Tower. It allows loop running around the perimeter of the layout, handy for equipment break-in and simple running during open house visits. The layout has wide curving aisles with a 3-foot minimum width and a lift section for access. In three locations, raised floor platforms were built to provide an eye-level view of the train. Layout construction. Layout construction began in January 2006 with the much appreciated help of friends in an informal Monday night trains group. The first task was to build and suspend the Pittsburgh Division staging yard. That was followed by building the Altoona yard and Middle Division main line. Next, they built the four-track Pittsburgh Division main up the 2.2% grade west of Altoona around Horseshoe Curve and connected it with the previously installed suspended staging tracks on the west side of the Gallitzin Tunnels. The mainline route was completed in August 2009, just 31 months after starting construction. The Tyrone and Clearfield branch from Osceola Mills to the Middle Division mainline at Gray Tower was finished in November 2010. Terrain was created using a cardboard web covered with red rosin paper followed by plaster cloth. A top coat of gypsolite was then brushed on the plaster cloth for rigidity and texture. The rock faces are a layer of molding plaster hand-carved before it fully cured. The trees are dried goldenrod sprigs wrapped with floral tape, dipped in diluted white glue, and sprinkled with ground foam. Densely planted, they make a fair-looking eastern forest. Operations. Within Ed's train group, there are those who prefer running through trains on the main line, while others enjoy local freight and branch line switching. The layout can accommodate both. Altoona serves as the division point between the Middle and Pittsburgh divisions. All trains stop there for simulated crew changes. Passenger and diesel freight power run through Altoona, while the division-assigned steam locomotives are exchanged there. With the exception of transfer runs to the Tyrone and Clearfield branch, and a Middle Division local freight, most trains passing through Altoona are scheduled timetable moves that don't require switching in the yard. A dispatcher controls train movements by issuing verbal orders to the towermen, and in turn, they control movement in their area by setting routes and signals using local control panels along the aisle. The hidden staging yards at the east and west ends of the mainline route have five separate loop tracks that can hold 30 to 35 car trains. The staging yards are monitored by closed-circuit TV. At the direction of the dispatcher, towermen control movements in and out of staging. During scheduled operations, trains don't run through staging. They enter and lay over in staging as one train, and later, when scheduled, leave as a different one running in the opposite direction. Most freight trains run over the two divisions of the layout without changes to the consist. When necessary, switching is handled by the Altoona yard crew. Two of the three 18-car stub-end tracks in Middle Division staging are used by the Altoona turn and coal transfer runs serving the Huntington and Broad Top Mountain Railroad, H&BT, and Tyrone and Clearfield, T&C, branch interchange tracks. Signature signals. Ed wanted working Penzi-style signals on his layouts, but for several years, scenery was a higher priority. By 2019, the railroad was far enough along to consider a signal project. By that time, the National Model Railroad Association's Layout Command Control, LCC, standards had been adopted and new products with advanced signals control capability had come on the market. He began the project by studying PRR signaling practices in the Keystone. Based on those practices and things he observed on early field trips, Ed developed a plan with a mix of 55-block, interlocking, and dwarf position light signals. The plan has 15 signal bridges, some precision-scale brass imports, and several kit-bashed plasticville ones, sized to fit the track arrangement. The well-detailed PRR signals are by Custom Signals and Atlas O. The signals are controlled by RR Circuits signal LCC boards distributed around the layouts on Cat5 eBus. Ed used JMRI Panel Pro software to configure the signal LCC boards to determine the aspect to display and drive the signal head LEDs. Ready to run, but more to do. Most of the layout's operational and scenery features are in place, but Ed views model railroading as a journey, not a destination to arrive at. In particular, he looks forward to refining operations and enhancing the scenery. Meet Ed Rapp. Ed Rapp is a retired federal employee living in Williamsburg, Virginia, with his wife Judy. His working career was centered on developing and managing information systems supporting national defense. His capstone assignment was serving as Deputy Chief of Staff for Information Management, Military Traffic Management Command. This is Ed's fourth O-scale model railroad. His pre-retirement layout in Fairfax, Virginia, was featured in the March 2000 issue of Model Railroader. Ed is a longtime member of the Pennsylvania Railroad Technical and Historical Society and shares his interest in model railroading with friends in the Ford's Colony Model Railroad Club. Thank you for joining us for the Model Railroader. My name is Jason Consul.
You've been listening to The Model Railroader, brought to you by Trains.com, that's TRANES.com, in collaboration with the Audio Information Network of Colorado. If you enjoyed this episode, we invite you to visit our website at aincolorado.org, where you can find more audio editions and original podcasts. For additional inquiries or to connect with us, feel free to give us a call at 303-786-7777. Thank you for listening.